give us the Mars Direct plan and how would it work? How many astronauts would go? What would be there before they even got there?
Okay. Mars Direct is a plan whereby we can send humans to Mars with present-day technology. You need a heavy lift booster with a capability equal to the Saturn V moon rockets we used in the 1960s. You do the mission with two launches. The first launch is sent to Mars in Earth return vehicle with no one in it. Now, this thing flies out to Mars unfueled, okay? It lands on Mars, and then you run a pump, and you suck in the Martian air, which is mostly carbon dioxide gas. You react that carbon dioxide with a small amount of hydrogen you brought from Earth to produce a large supply of methane oxygen rocket propellant. Once that is done, then you launch the other rocket, and that shoots the crew out to Mars. I prefer a crew of four, but five or six is also possible. They fly out to Mars. They take 6 months to get there. They land on Mars in the immediate vicinity of the Earth return vehicle. Okay, they because the return ride is waiting for them on Mars, they don't have to fly to Mars in some gigantic, futuristic Battlestar Galactica spaceship that we don't have to know how to build.
Well, what if something happens to the fuel, or what if it's not there? I mean, is
it... Well, no, the fuel is there. The fuel has already been made before they ever left Earth. Okay, and in the way I would do this plan, they fly out to Mars in convoy with a second Earth return vehicle, which provides a backup for them in any case.
Okay, all right, okay. So there will be a backup.
Yes.
All right.
Now, they fly out to Mars in convoy with a second Earth return vehicle. They land first, and they check out the first Earth return vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
If it's fine, we could land the second Earth return vehicle anywhere else. I like landing it at some distance away, perhaps a couple of hundred miles, because it will define the next landing site, but it will still be available to the first crew if they need it. They could drive to it.
Sure.
Now, so they live on Mars in the same habitat that they flew to Mars in.
Are they in the same kind of a lunar spaceship, spacesuits that we had back in the 69 and the early 70s, or is it a different kind of suit? Is it a lighter suit, smaller suit?
Okay, well, first of all, in the spaceship, they don't need a suit. They're living in shirt sleeves.
Okay.
Okay, they're living in a big tuna can-shaped habitat, perhaps around 27 feet in diameter and 20 feet tall, so you got two decks, each with 10 feet of headroom, okay? And these, by the way, are exactly the kind of habitats that the Mars Society members live in the Arctic and in the desert in our simulated Mars
mission
we're conducting. That's talked about in my book, Mars on Earth, which we might want to get to in a
minute.
Yes. Okay, but the they're quite livable. Okay, when you go outside, you need a spacesuit. The spacesuits would probably look something like the Apollo spacesuits that we had in the 60s. Much more like that than the space shuttle suits. The space shuttle suits are just designed to operate in zero-G.
Right.
The Apollo suits were designed to use on the surface of a planet, so they're more the sort of thing that you'd want. But we'd want our suits, if possible, to be lighter than Apollo suits, and more importantly, actually, more maintainable. Because you're going to be on Mars for a year and a half exploring, and you need a suit that can be maintained by this crew of four to six people on Mars, and used for hundreds of EVAs.
Oh, yeah, and you're going to have backup suits.
Yeah, you'll want backup suits and backup parts, but that said, you'll want these things to be maintainable and simple.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a certain amount of technical challenge to creating suits that are this good, but I think we can do it.
So they're there. How long do you think they stay on the planet?
They're on Mars for a year and a half.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it takes 6 months to go to Mars. You stay on Mars for a year and a half while the planets move around to give you a launch window back to Earth. And at the end of the year and a half, you take off in your Earth return vehicle. You leave your habitat behind on Mars. So each time you do this, you add another habitat to Mars, to either a string of habitats stretched across the terrain, like a string of warming huts, or you could concentrate landings all in one area and create a major base. Okay, or some combination of that. The plan's flexible.
Well, Robert, do you think man could sustain himself mentally and emotionally on a planet like that for a year and a half?
Well, sure. Look, you know, Lewis and Clark went out for 3 years. Whalers in the 19th century went out for 3 years at a time. My father was away in World War II for 3 years.
But, you know, they weren't strapped in suits. They didn't have...
But look, they were eating, I mean, those... Whalers were eating hardtack and you know, sleeping in hammocks below decks on pitching ships, and you know, the soldiers who were away at war during World War II, you know, were sleeping in muddy trenches and, you know, being you know, shelled by Japanese and bossed around by 90-day wonders. And I mean, you know, compare that to the position of human explorers going to Mars with the full support of the world community behind that. Compare that to, I mean, you know, Anne Frank and her family were in an attic for 2.5 years with Nazis running around on the outside with listening devices. The human factors challenge of a Mars mission is more stressful than most of our daily lives today, but it's hardly more stressful than what any number of people put up with in human history.
Mars on Earth, of course, your book that came out in 2003. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, well, Mars on Earth tells the story of how we learned how to explore Mars in the high Arctic. In the Canadian Arctic, there is an island called Devon Island. It's 900 miles from the North Pole, and it has a huge meteor crater in it, 20 kilometers across, that has created all kinds of Mars-like geology. And, in fact, NASA scientists have been visiting the place for about 5 years in order to try to learn about Mars geology through geological comparisons with Devon. Well, when the Mars Society was founded, we decided that what we do as our first project is establish a Mars station there, an architectural duplicate of an actual Mars mission habitat, and continue the exploration of Devon, but do it in the same style that you'd have to do on Mars. In other words, you can't go outside without wearing a spacesuit. Okay, you got to talk from spacesuit to spacesuit by radio. You can't use sound. And, you know, and you have this crew of six in this hab, all alone, okay, having to do the field exploration and the lab work and the repair of equipment and the reportage and tend to the chores of daily life and get along with each other, you know, in the middle of this polar desert up there in the Arctic. And by so doing, learn what exploration techniques work on Mars, what skill mix is needed, what tools are needed, what kind of robotic assistance are the most useful to the crew, all this kind of stuff. So we did that, and we're still doing that. Okay, we have two habs now, one in the Arctic and one in the American desert.
Are there people there now?
Well, there's a crew in the desert hab right now as we speak, and it's commanded right now by an Australian. Reese Lovston from the Australian Air Force is the crew commander. We have an international crew there at the moment. But we have, and we occupy the Arctic hab in the summertime and the Utah hab in the fall, winter, and spring. Utah is not as good a simulant as Mars as Devon Island, but it's a lot easier to get to and a lot cheaper, and we can test out things in Utah before we test them in the Arctic.